Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton, and you're listening to ICYMI.
In case you missed it.
Slate's podcast about internet culture. And usually we do a little bit of silly banter here, but today we wanted to start by saying that for the first 10 or so minutes of this episode, we will be discussing child abuse. So feel free to skip to our conversation with Fortessa Latifi after the break if that is not something you want to hear.
So today we are talking about a story that's been bubbling up for a while and has now reached the halls of state legislation. Back in August of 2023, Illinois passed a child influencer law that would compensate and protect children under the age of 16 whose parents have made money off them via social media content, YouTube vlogs, anything online that accrues revenue. And since then, six more states have proposed legislation with similar tenets. But we're having this conversation because there's been a recent scandal surrounding a vlogger family in Utah that I think we should talk about.
Right. So the same month that Illinois passed their child influencer law, Ruby Frankie, a family blogger in Utah, was arrested on child abuse charges. She was arrested with her friend, Jody Hildebrand, who was watching Frankie's kids when Frankie's 12-year-old son escaped from a window in Hildebrand's home. He ran to a neighbor's house asking for food, water, and help.
And according to the police, the boy had wound marks and duct tape around his wrists and ankles. Soon after, the police found Frankie's 10-year-old daughter in a, quote, similar physical condition of malnourishment. Child Protective Services ended up taking four of Frankie's kids into custody.
And Frankie and Hildebrand are not only friends, they're also business partners who run a life coaching business together called Connections with an X. They also run a podcast and an Instagram page called Moms of Truth, where they have given some pretty alarming parenting advice, saying things like children don't deserve privacy and parents shouldn't love their children unconditionally. On top of being accused of cult-like teachings in these podcasts and on this Instagram page, the two women allegedly made racist, ableist, and transphobic remarks on these platforms.
And as we mentioned up top, Frankie also ran a huge YouTube channel called 8 Passengers. She had almost 2.5 million subscribers, and she posted vlogs about her family, including her husband, who has since filed for divorce, and her six kids. And while the YouTube channel has been taken down, along with the Instagram pages associated with Connections, viewers have been able to pull back footage and publish the many red flags they missed the first time, including the time Frankie made her teenage son go on camera and tell us why he wasn't allowed to sleep in his bedroom for 7 months and ended up sleeping on a beanbag in the living room.
Or another moment when Frankie's 6-year-old daughter forgot to pack a lunch, and when her teacher texted saying, "Hey, could you bring your daughter some food to school?" Frankie refused and explained that she hopes no one gives her daughter food so that her daughter will come home and learn how painful it is to be hungry all day.
Now, going back to the date of the arrest, you know, Frankie's family lived in this pretty nice big house in Ivins, Utah. And People magazine spoke to a neighbor who described this place as a, quote, affluent, tight-knit neighborhood. So there was a bit of surprise that this family, who is constantly broadcasting how much they love each other, how fun their house is, would be hiding so much darkness behind the scenes. But when Frankie and Hildebrand were arrested, some people were not surprised at all.
Frankie's four youngest kids were taken into custody by Child Protective Services, but she has two older kids, one of whom is 20-year-old Sherry Frankie, who is also a YouTuber. When her mom was arrested, Sherry posted on Instagram that, quote, "Today has been a big day," end quote. Sherry continues, quote, "We've been trying to tell the police and CPS for years about this, and we're so glad that they finally decided to step up."
Days later, Ruby Frankie's three sisters, all of whom are family influencers, shared a joint statement saying, quote, "For the last 3 years, we have kept quiet on the subject of our sister Ruby Frankie for the sake of her children." They continued, quote, "Ruby was arrested, which needed to happen. Jody was arrested, which needed to happen. The kids are now safe, which is the number one priority."
And soon after this, a neighbor revealed that they had called police before because, quote, "They saw some weird things," end quote. And someone even started a change.org petition back in 2020 called Get 8 Passengers, Ruby Frankie, Under Investigation for Child Abuse. Hildebrand's niece also spoke out, saying that she herself was abused by her aunt in ways that were very similar to those of Frankie's children.
In December, Frankie pled guilty to 4 counts of aggravated child abuse. And in February, both Frankie and Hildebrand were sentenced to 4 separate prison sentences, which they will serve consecutively and span between 1 and 15 years.
At her sentencing, Frankie said, "I will never stop crying for hurting your tender souls." While Hildebrand said, "I desire for them to heal physically and emotionally." But what's clear at this point is that the damage they inflicted upon Frankie's kids and Hildebrand's niece has really kind of begged a bigger, more harrowing question. How did this family hide so much wrongdoing, abuse, and pain when they were broadcasting their lives constantly?
It's a question I've asked a lot as more and more children of family vloggers and parent influencers have come out and spoken about the real conditions they were asked to perform and smile under. But not everyone is empowered or given the protection to speak out about living and working as a child influencer, because there are no protections. This is not a quantitative or clearly defined industry, but states are starting to argue that it's labor and it's child labor.
When we talk about child actors, we often bring up the Coogan Law, which is a law that is very important, but also importantly, not a fail-safe. Child influencers don't even have a Coogan Law in most states, at least up until recently. Today, we are going to be talking about a recent raft of child influencer laws introduced in a few different states and what they're trying to accomplish and how they might protect the past, present, and future kids of the internet. We will be back with Fortessa Latifi, who has written about these laws, after a quick break.
Hey there. If you love our podcast, then maybe you should consider subscribing to Slate Plus. With Slate Plus, there are no ads on any Slate podcasts. And Slate Plus helps keep this podcast going, because this show would not be possible without your support. With Slate Plus, you'll get bonus segments and episodes for shows like Political Gab Fest, Amicus, and Culture Gap Fest. You'll also never hit a paywall on the Slate website, meaning you get access to every article and every advice column. Just visit slate.com/ICYMI+ to sign up. That's slate.com/ICYMI+.
And we're back with Fortessa Latifi, a journalist who has written for The Washington Post, The New York Times, Bitch Media, Rest in Peace, and Teen Vogue. It is for that last publication that she's been covering a raft of recent laws in states like Maryland, Illinois, California, and at least 3 others, laws that are aimed not only at protecting the profits of child influencers, but their privacy. Fortessa, welcome to ICYMI.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, Fortessa. As a first-time guest on the show, there is a question we must ask all first-time guests, which is, what is your first internet memory?
Oh my gosh. You know what it is being in elementary school and wanting to leave like away messages on my computer.
Yes.
And my older sisters who were in high school being like, no one cares what you're doing and we need to leave away messages, you know? So we were like beefing about that.
Wow. I grew up only with brothers. So whenever I hear about sisters, I'm just endlessly fascinated because the level of terror is so much more sophisticated from a sister than a brother.
It's mental warfare. Yeah.
And it is. Unfortunately, we're not here to talk about sibling dynamics.
Bummer.
Although, actually, a little bit. The real reason we are here is child influencers. And to my mind, I would say there are 2 different kinds of child influencer. There are children like little Tay, who I would say is like the star of their own production and their family is largely behind the camera. And then there are children like the children of Colleen Ballinger or Miranda Sings, who are part of a family vlog type deal. But I wanted to ask you, Fortessa, if you feel like that's an accurate summary of the space. And if it is, how would you kind of differentiate between the kinds of content produced by the two?
Yeah, I do think in a way that's a helpful framing, because there are the kids who are like the star of the show, and then there are the kids who are like on an ensemble cast. But I think also you never know like how much the family is actually in the background or how much they're like pushing the kid out there. But I do think that's helpful to think of like you're an influencer on your own, or you're part of this larger like family vlog system.
Yeah, I think that plays a lot into who really has the power, who really makes the money, who is considered a valuable asset, who is considered replaceable. And we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. But speaking of Lil Tay, you know, Lil Tay was a rapper, I guess we could say, who had this viral death hoax back in August. She did end up being alive, but that created some questions about like who is pushing the stuff. And that sparked some pretty intense discussion online about like the lives of child influencers. That same month, the governor of Illinois signed into law an amendment to the state's child labor law that would require parents to compensate their children for their appearances in monetized content. And it drew comparisons to like the Coogan Law, which was a California law signed back in 1939 to protect child actors. That law also requires parents to like safeguard a portion of their children's earnings for when the child turns 18. Though that was the first of its kind, and it's been joined by multiple other state-level laws in the months since. And so, in your words, do you feel like these laws are pretty similar to each other? If not, what are some key differences?
I think these influencer laws are kind of the Coogan Law of the 21st century. So the Coogan Law was protecting child actors, right? And now these are kind of the new child actors. And they are similar because both the Coogan Law and the Illinois law require like a certain percentage of the money that the child makes is saved for them in a trust until they turn 18. So that's very similar. And they are both child entertainers, right? But I think the fascinating thing is that people are like, but we have child actor laws. Well, first of all, we don't have a federal child actor law. So it's dependent like on the state level, whether kids are protected as child actors in that state. And also child influencers are not considered child actors. Like they are this whole other thing. And so I think the thing about the Illinois law is it was really modernizing the Coogan law for the 21st century. And we need that because these kids are just kind of left in the wild west right now of unregulation.
That's such a good point. I feel like whenever we speak to internet culture reporters or people who have been covering this for a while, there's this shift that a lot of people kind of point to around like the end of the 2010s, beginning of 2020s, where influencers became less of a Wild West and more of a real kind of corporate entity. But that shift feels like it's coming very late for children.
It is, because I mean, the first mommy blogs were monetized back in 2005, right? So we're in 2024. That's almost 20 years later. This is a multi-billion dollar, decades old. I know, 20 years after. 20, yeah, it's crazy. But this is a multi-billion dollar, decades old industry. So that's the thing that really kind of strikes me with these laws is like, it is incredible that Illinois made history and passed the first law that protects child influencers. And at the same time, so many kids have already slipped through the cracks because this is not new and this is not a small industry.
Yeah. And that's like a question I do have about these laws, which I do think are pushing us in the right direction, but I do think there are possible loopholes. You know, the first one just being the fact that, like, what if you are a grown adult who was a child of a mommy vlogger? Is there a statute of limitations? Is there some type of like back pay you can get there? You know, on top of that, a lot of the laws kind of consist around this idea that, like, for example, your child, if they are under 16, will be given 30% of the revenue that your family, let's say, makes off a vlog for the first like 30 days. And I think what rings a little off to me is I'm like, well, first off, that's just the edited cut. What about the raw? What if you were a child who was asked to be filmed for 1 hour going to Toys R Us and you only make like 15% of that video? Therefore, are you eligible for the cut? Is there labor? Is there like a day rate? Like there's, I don't know. Do you feel like these laws are at least going in the right direction, or do you also feel a little caution?
I do think they're going in the right direction. I think that any amount of regulation in this space is meaningful and helpful, but it is difficult because, for example, like I'm in LA, my husband works in film. Like we talk about this and he's like, you wouldn't believe like when we have kids on set, like the amount of regulations that we have, like we have to stop at a certain time for them to have, you know, an hour long lunch and then they have to go to tutoring for however many hours. And then we have to finish at a good time for kids to like finish working. They can only work however many hours a day. And we don't have that in the influencer world. Like these kids could still be working pretty constantly and not have those labor protections. So I do think there's so much more to be done, but I think anything that is done is meaningful and a step in the right direction.
I think what we're all kind of circling around here is that these laws feel like they've been a long time coming. For your Team Vogue piece, these states are trying to get influencers to pay their kids. You interviewed Carolyn Isom, who satirizes family vlogs in her videos about the fictional sandwich family. We're going to play a clip of one of her TikToks.
Hey, Mom, can I talk to you about something really quick?
Sure, but set up the camera first.
You know how you said that if any of your kids didn't want to make videos anymore, all they would have to do is say so?
I don't recall ever saying that.
Okay, but you have said it. You said it 22 different times in 9 separate videos.
Why are you watching the videos?
I really don't. I really don't want to make any more videos.
I really wish it were that simple, but you've got a line of bath products coming out next month and a line of sauces in June. You've got projects scheduled through 2026, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, we can cancel the projects.
Do you realize how much money we would lose out on if we canceled all of your projects?
Why do we need more money? We've already made a lot of money on this channel.
Who told you the channel's made a lot of money?
Sunny told me, and she knows those things.
Well, if I tell you something, will you promise not to say anything to Sunny?
Yeah, I promise.
This is ultimately my fault because I trusted Sunny to handle our finances, but she made some bad investments, and now we're broke. I really wish you could quit Sarah Grace, but we just can't afford it right now.
Can I just say that, like, in all the reporting we've done on this show since I've started here, that is, like, the darkest video I've seen.
It's really dark. And I think the thing that makes it the darkest is that it really does reflect reality. So I wrote this story for Teen Vogue about parent influencers and the children who had their childhood made into content. And for that story, I talked to a young woman. She's a teenager. I'm being very careful because I was keeping her anonymous in the story. But she grew up in a YouTube vlogging family. And she's still in that. And at one point she told her dad, like, I don't want to make videos anymore. And her dad said, yeah, okay, that's fine. But, you know, we're going to have to sell the house. Your mom and I are going to have to go back to work. There's not going to be as much money for fun things. Like, you might have to go to, like, you know, aftercare, you know, after school or whatever. And so, like, what kind of option is that really to, like, give your kids, you know? And the pressure that these influencer kids, and I've spoken to several of them, the pressure that they feel financially, like, they do feel like that burden is on their shoulders. So I think that's the striking thing about the whole, like, sandwich family videos is that, like, it actually echoes what these kids are telling me in real life.
I'm sorry, I'm really stuck on a parent telling their child, I might have to go back to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, go back to work. You're an,
like,
adult.
That's the deal. That's the deal, is that you go take care of me. Like, I'm a child.
Exactly. And Caroline's Sandwich Family series is incredibly popular, like, has over 100 million views on all the videos. And she said she thinks it's popular because people have been looking for an outlet to talk about this. And I was curious in your reporting whether you found that generally people are kind of scared to talk about it, or if they feel like they've just gotten permission to talk about it. I feel like in the past year, the conversation has really kind of intensified in a way that's very well deserved.
Yeah. Yeah, the conversation has definitely changed. I mean, I think it's difficult to talk about because there are so many fans of this content. And I don't think anyone is, like, trying to vilify the fans, because there's a reason that we're interested in content like this, right? Like, it's just like watching a reality TV show about a family. It's like a different version of, like, the Kardashians. Like, we're just all so curious about each other and we want to see how other people live. And I don't think that it's useful to, like, vilify the viewers necessarily. But like, I've talked to some of them and they're like, I feel morally strange about these decisions that I'm making. I'm trying to pull back. And I do think that we are just having this conversation and it's a helpful one to be having. And I hope that it leads to real change. And it seems like it is, because right now there are 8 states that are considering legislation. And just last year, there were only 2. And so that's a huge change. We're only 2 months into 2024.
Mm-hmm. And Esom said something else that we wanted to touch on, which is that she told you, quote, "For me, one of the biggest issues that comes with family vlogging is the oversharing of information about a child. My frustration is these parents are telling their children's stories as if they are your own. Your daughter's first period is not your story to tell. Your kid getting bullied at school is not your story to tell." So for Tessa, how many of these laws address the privacy concerns inherent to the genre?
So there are 4 different states. It's Missouri, Ohio, Maryland, and Minnesota, where there are possible privacy protections. And basically what that means is that at a certain age, the child could reach out to the social media companies and request permanent deletion of content. And so that content would not exist anymore or be hosted like on that website anymore. I think what's difficult about that is that information doesn't only exist in one place. So let's say you take down the YouTube video announcing like the daughter's first period or whatever, like people still make like other videos like reacting to that. But you know what I mean? Like It just proliferates in this way that I don't know can really be controlled. I do think it's helpful to be able to request that deletion and hopefully it would make that information harder to find. But like, I mean, didn't all our parents tell us like the internet is forever?
Yeah. Yeah. So true. The right to be forgotten component is part of other digital advocacy laws, right?
Yeah. So it's a European legal doctrine. We don't have it in the US yet, but it's basically the idea that the internet doesn't have to be forever and information people post about you or that you post about yourself doesn't have to exist forever. And there's a way to delete it.
Mm-hmm. And let's take a short break. But when we come back, we'll talk about how reporting on child influencer laws has changed the way Fortessa views their content.
And we're back. So one of the states that has this right to be forgotten component is Maryland, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they recently had a hearing where activists and like former child bloggers gave their testimonials in support of the bill. And we wanted to play a little bit of what 25-year-old Cam Barrett said to the legislators. Barrett posts under @softscorpio. And she had private details of her life shared to her mother's 10,000 Facebook followers, including her first menstrual cycle and photos from a car accident.
First, I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman and ranking members of the committee, for your time. My name is Cam Barrett, and I'm an international advocate who fights to end the exploitation of children on social media. As a former content kid myself, I know what it's like to grow up with a digital footprint I never asked for. As my mom posted to the world my first ever menstrual cycle, as she posted to the world the intimate details about me being adopted, her platform grew and I had no say in what was posted. When I was younger, there wasn't necessarily a source to monetize each post. However, there have always been brand deals. In exchange for content, my mom received free concert tickets from Live Nation resellers who viewed her posts. After I was hit by a drunk driver, her connection said they would pay for me to go to see artists like Demi Lovato or Taylor Swift in exchange for promotional posts. At that age, I became vigilantly hyper aware of my surroundings, developed an anxiety disorder I have to this day, and dropped out of high school. That's when posing became a full-time job for me. As we know, social media has drastically changed over the past several years in a way where it's much more accessible for parents to turn their children into a quick source of income. In these situations, most blogger parents will pull their children out of school so they have more opportunities. And I'll be the first to admit that it leads to a very quick burnout. As an adult, I'm still learning how to navigate this life with a digital footprint I can't remove. I've been diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder and an anxiety disorder that is so debilitating, I'm unable to hold a job. Members of the committee, I plead with you to think about this generation of children who give their parents free labor to maintain a social media presence. Maryland has the opportunity to protect the child influencers who reside in this state from facing a monetized childhood only to be met with nothing in return at 18, along with having no say in a digital footprint they never asked for.
And I think what's striking to me about this clip, besides everything, is just how profoundly the scale has changed in the years since Cam Barrett was being posted. Her mother had 10,000 Facebook followers. Some of the biggest child influencers and family vloggers on the internet have hundreds of millions of followers. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe even more insidiously, it's actually quite hard as an average internet consumer to avoid content featuring children if you wanted to. I think some of the most enduring memes of our time come from children being recorded. Look at all those chickens. It's just the kids looking at a bunch of ducks.
Yeah.
And I can't really scroll for longer than an hour without encountering a child doing something cute. And as someone who loves kids, it's not like I avoid it.
Same.
And so I wanted to ask if you feel like the sentiment behind these laws that maybe children shouldn't be posted nearly as much as they currently are is spreading. And if it does, what does the internet look like afterwards? Is there no more Corn Kid? Should we just be okay with an internet without Corn Kid?
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard because, like, look at all those chickens example. Also, my husband and I say that to each other like once a week. Like, it's
truly
enduring meme. Like, it's so funny. And, like, I don't know, to me there is a difference between that and, like, posting the details of someone's, like, medical diagnosis or someone's, like, first menstrual period. But then again, like, I did embarrassing things when I was a kid that my family thought was really cute and that I was really embarrassed by. And if they had put it online and it had gone viral and people were still talking about it 10 years later, like, I probably would have been really, really mad and really embarrassed. Yeah. So I don't know what the answer is, but I do think, and I'm working on a story for the Washington Post about this right now, that we're seeing the changes in how people are posting their kids online. Like, even regular people who aren't influencers are not posting their kids as much. Like, I wrote this story that was, the new pregnancy announcement is no announcement. Like, people aren't announcing their pregnancies in the same way anymore. They're not doing gender reveals in the same way anymore. And lots of regular people are keeping their kids offline, or they'll, like, post them. It's funny because it's kind of like this trickle down of, like, the way that celebrities have done it with their kids. They'll post them with emojis over their faces, or like a hand in front of their face, or just from the back or something. So people are posting their kids less. And I think it's this understanding of this online footprint that they didn't ask for.
Yeah. I also remember watching one person named Chris McCarthy.
Yes.
Also testify in support of a bill called HB 645.
Greetings and thank you to Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, ranking members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris McCarthy and I am representing the organization Quit Looking Kids. I am offering favorable testimony for House Bill 0645. I want you all to picture something. A family gathered for a holiday, someone holding a camera and everyone laughing and waving. Years later, the people gather together and watch the video that documents their happiness. The children in the family have grown, and they may be embarrassed at their younger selves, but the event stays in the family. That was then. Now imagine a similar family. Similar, but not the same. They're gathered for a holiday too, but this time someone pulls out a smartphone instead of a camcorder. This time the children who embarrass themselves must live with antics that will be recorded, shared, and may live forever online. The content shifts from home videos to grades, mental and physical health struggles, and even other compromising situations. This information is then used as clickbait to generate intrigue and revenue for a monetized family channel. These accounts are known as family vlogging accounts, and they diminish children's privacy by using these moments as clickbait. One family has even monetized the birthing video of their child, introducing somebody to this world who grow up in front of a camera, lose the privacy of childhood, and generate revenue for their family without a guarantee of financial compensation.
They gave this really interesting example of how, like, you know, when you post your child on Instagram, there's a good chance you're just doing it just to, like, document their life. It's documentation. Yeah. It's like, I want to have photos of my kid as they grow up. Fair. But, you know, Chris brings up the fact that there is a difference between having a fun time with your family. Someone pulls out the camcorder, records it. We have a great laugh. Now there is this question of, like, well, what if that camcorder was an iPhone? What if that iPhone was streaming live? And what if that iPhone was basically taking your most embarrassing moment as a kid so you can't even like consent to it and it's out there, people are commenting. All of a sudden, you're on the Today Show. But yeah. There's something there about the way that the motives have changed along with the technology, along with the monetization. I mean, I kind of actually just wanted to ask about like your draw to this beat a little bit. Like, what is it about the way that like we see our kids not as people, but as products? Like, what's going on there?
I don't know. It's so strange. I think it's also just the way that we commodify everything, like in late stage capitalism, 21st century life. Like, every hobby is like, oh, make an Instagram, sell it on Etsy, you know, make TikToks and get paid that way. Like, everything is commodified. So it kind of makes sense to like commodify parenthood in a way. And I do also want to be sensitive to the fact that like it's much more difficult for women to like stay in their careers or to create careers, especially in America where we have no federally mandated maternity leave. And, you know, so I do want to be sensitive to all those things, but I just think like, there are so many questions that haven't been asked about what this will mean in the future and what it means to grow up like with a camera constantly in your face. And I do think there's like a big difference between this and child actors, because I think about like Hilary Duff was like famous for being Lizzie McGuire, right? Yeah. You know, like maybe there was like a spread in 17 magazine. It was like Hilary Duff's favorite color is blue and she has a crush on, you know, whatever. But it wasn't like I couldn't follow her every single day and see every single like and dislike and milestone. Like, I liked Lizzie McGuire. It wasn't her. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. No, that's such a good distinction to draw, like getting involved in a child actor's career versus a child influencer who's just living their life, but it happens to be on camera.
Right.
I mean, kind of speaking of child actors, these laws are drawing a lot of comparisons to the Coogan Law, but as we see with stories like Jeanette McCurdy, the Coogan Law isn't a fail-safe, and these child influencer laws are certainly better than nothing, which is what we have right now in most places. But I'm curious as to what you think might be the next legislative step, or if there will be one.
It's difficult because when I think about the steps that we have in place for child actors, like that they can only work a certain amount of hours a day or whatever, like there are people on movie sets whose job it is to make sure that that's followed, right? And how do you do that in someone's home? Like, you can't really. It's like reality TV, but the parent is the producer and the creator and the filmographer. And it's just like, I don't know how you can do that. And I don't know how you can control what parents put online about their kids. And there's a lot of discussion about like, well, you just shouldn't be able to monetize content with kids in it. And it's like, but why would the social media companies ever go for that? Because they make so much money off of it. Like I said, it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And part of me feels like we've ignored it for so long that I don't know how you like put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak.
Yeah. And all of the laws we've spoken about have been adopted or introduced at like a state level. And the Coogan Law is also a state level bill, California. Do you see federal intervention at any point becoming a reality?
I mean, it's strange because in America, it's like states' rights, you know, and that's something that we see all the time with like the Second Amendment and, you know, gun laws and charter schools, you know, everything is kind of left to the states. And like, logically, I don't think that we will see a federal intervention, but I do think that more federal politicians on that federal level are starting to think about this issue. And maybe it'll become normal for it to be passed at the state level. But I think if we still don't have a federal child actor law, like, I think the odds that we get a federal child influencer law are pretty slim. And I mean, even like reality TV kids are left in the dust in all of this. Like, they don't count as actors either. And then you see these states like Arkansas trying to repeal child labor laws in general. So it's like, what are the odds that they're going to be like, oh yeah, but we need this specific child labor law? Like, I guess not.
Yeah. I think what's really getting to me is that we're in this moment of really heightened emotion about supposedly protecting children. When you see the justification for book bans or anti-trans legislation, what you see is something about keeping children safe. And yet here's an issue that's clear cut or that feels really clear cut, but only one state in the entire United States of America has passed a law about it. I don't know. You think you get used to hypocrisy and then it's right here.
I know. It's completely legal in 49 states for them to reach the age of 18, have worked their entire lives and have nothing to show for it. It's totally fine. And that's really bananas to me.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And can I ask, Vertessa, you know, you have done a lot of reporting on this. There's bound to be more reporting to come. I mean, how has reporting about family vloggers and child influencer laws made you change the way you yourself interact with content featuring children?
Yeah, it's funny because I'll be on TikTok and I'll like see a cute video of a kid and I'll like it and then I'll like unlike it because I'm like, wait, I don't know. This kid didn't like consent to this or like, oh, I don't know. I feel weird about this. And I was never like someone who followed like family vloggers really. But like, I think my interest in this comes from being a teenager during the 16 and pregnant teen mom era when we were like all obsessed with like those kids and those moms. And some of them are like still on TV and they're approaching the age that their parents were when they had them, and their entire life from gestation to teenagehood has been captured online. And it used to be this like really small cohort of kids, right? Like it was like the Duggar kids, the Gosling kids, the teen mom kids. But now it's like that it could be anyone.
Okay, that's the show. I want to thank Fortessa Latifi for joining us on today's episode. You can follow her at Hi Fortessa on all platforms, and stay tuned for more Fortessa's coverage on influencer kids, their parents, and what they have to say about the controversy surrounding child influencers. We'll be back in your feed on Wednesday, so definitely subscribe. That way, you never miss an episode. Leave us a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify, and tell your friends about us. You can follow us on Twitter at @ICYMI_pod. And you can always drop us a note at ICYMI@slate.com.
ICYMI is produced by Sarah Spragley-Ricks, Candace Lim, and me, Rachel Hampton. Daisy Rosario is our senior supervising producer, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's vice president of audio. See you online.
Or not.